From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It was very, very exciting. Very exciting, very rewarding, and it's hard to explain. I mean, it was today for me, it's like that was it. That was really the life. We were all so equal. Even when we weren't equal, we took each other by hand and just pulled each other in. There was no such thing as you can't do it, or somebody would say, well, I've never done that. Say, come on, let me show you how to do that.
Right.
I pulled somebody into a job on TV doing weather. She had no idea what to do, and I was afraid I would lose it if I told the station manager that I wasn't going to do it and I was giving it to someone else. And I pulled her in, taught her, got her on the air. And I thought they were going to try to kill me. But it turned out that she was good. She was good enough to go on by the time I trained her. So they accepted that. They would never do that today.
Mary D., award-winning broadcaster and author. D. has MD Communications, a consulting practice that inspires individuals and employees to rise above challenges and seize control of their destinies. She is a celebrated motivational and inspirational speaker, moderator, a life-changing career coach, a successful fundraising strategist, and a fierce advocate for violence prevention. As a trailblazer in both television and radio, D. has served as newscaster, talk show host, and staff announcer. Also, she served as Director of Community Relations at Superstation WGN-TV and as advisor to other Tribune-owned television stations. For more than 30 years, Dee served as the co-host and presenter of the nationally syndicated UNCF annual Evening of Stars, raising tens of millions of dollars for college scholarships. She leveraged her relationship with the McCormick Foundation to raise more than $31 million for Chicago's children's charities. However, her support extends beyond raising funds. She advocates for organizations that address critical social needs, including issues surrounding adoption and foster care, education, and women's issues. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the legendary radio and television personality Mary D. In Black America.
I've been promoting life lessons on faith, forgiveness, and grace. And that book is not necessarily about the shooting and what happened to me.
Right.
It is a book about inspiration, about moving forward and making sure that you never believe that you can't. There is no can't if you can. If you want to, you can.
Mary D., legendary radio and television personality, shares insightful lessons she has learned throughout her life in a powerful memoir entitled Life Lessons of Faith, Forgiveness, and Grace. With unflinching honesty, she takes you from her humble beginnings on Chicago's South Side to a rise to the top as one of the most trusted names in media, philanthropy, and advocacy. In vivid and heartbreaking detail, Dee reveals the pain of losing her mother at a very young age and the horror of living with a cruel stepmother who constantly tortured her. Even as an adult, she was the victim of domestic violence perpetrated by her boyfriend, a famous R&B singer who physically and verbally abused her during their rocky relationship. Dee's 50-year career in Chicago broadcasting is admirable in itself. One of the first African-American women to anchor the news in the Windy City, Dee has parlayed her celebrity into charitable work. She has raised millions of dollars for children's charities, spearheaded victims' rights legislation, and helped increase adoption rates in Illinois. Recently, In Black America spoke with this iconic personality.
Born in Chicago, totally by accident. My mother was on the City of New Orleans train, went into labor, and I was born here. All the other children were born in New Orleans. So my family is New Orleans people, is Southerners. And raised partially in New Orleans and Chicago.
Tell her, what was life like growing up in those two different cities?
Do you have about 2 hours?
Kind of condense it for us.
Okay. As a little girl, I remember my Chicago days a lot more. Going to high school, I went back to New Orleans, and I spent 2 years in high school there. I just came back, as a matter of fact, a week ago, going back to visit my roots, and then came back to Chicago. Living in those days at that time were very, very, very different
mm-hmm.
than living now. I just said yesterday, speaking to a group, people were civil, honest, caring, loving, and didn't have to know you to do all of that. We're very different today.
Yes, we are. Understand that you attended Xavier University?
I went for 2 minutes.
2 minutes, and you had to go out and find a job.
I did.
And what was that first job?
I was a bag girl, which they called bag boys then. And I remember the gentleman telling me, he said, you can't work here. You're first of all, you're too young, and we can't have anybody here doing bagging. I mean, that's what boys do.
Right.
So the conversation went on as I had already been there. I watched. I knew what to do. And what sold him was, I said, you never put the eggs on the bottom. And I watched that guy put the eggs right on the bottom. And the bread was right over that. And he thought he was covering the eggs. And he looked at me and he says, well, okay, I'm going to give you a try.
And how did that work out?
I think it worked out pretty good, John.
I understand. I understand you worked for IBM for a while?
I did for 7 years.
And what did you do for them?
I traveled on the road for IBM. I assisted in setting up IBM installations all over the country, both in and out of the country. And at that time, that was when the supposed beginning of computers mm-hmm. were coming about. So I was really in the forefront there and had no idea how significant this time would be.
I understand that you eventually studied broadcasting and journalism because you had a gift to gab.
Actually, when I came off the road with IBM, it was because my daughter was going to school, mm-hmm. and I wanted to come home and play mommy. I felt that I needed to be here with her, so I came in. I had no job, was in the process of getting divorced. Mm-hmm. And I went from one thing to the other, and finally I was talking to a young lady who owned a modeling agency, and she said, well, why don't you come register with us? And I said, for what? What kind of job can I get there? I need to take care of my family.
Right.
I had sisters and brothers and nieces and nephews who really needed me at that time. I just thought that that was the funniest thing I had heard, and she said, oh, you've got a real gift of gab. You're nice and you're charming to people. You're very kind, and I think we can do something with you. And one of the first things that I did was the auto show, and that actually launched my career.
When looking back when you started some years ago, I had a conversation with Bernard Shaw, so I assume you all started in this industry around the same time.
Around the same time. Although I was a great admirer of his from the moment he went on.
What was it like doing that 4-hour shift? I always wanted to work at a radio station where you sat in a showroom and you saw people walking by.
It was frightening for me.
Was it?
Yes. I wanted it to be fun, and I looked forward to it. But I guess sitting there, you know, you don't want to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make mistakes, you don't want anybody to see it. And there I was in a showroom window, no way to do anything but something good. And I remember smiling at people and forgetting the record is off, smiling at people or saying hello when people came in to shake my hand, and I'm saying, shh, and they're not saying anything, but I was getting ready to go into news. So it was double jeopardy, really. I mean, you had to do a lot of different things. At that time, I had to be my own engineer.
Right.
And thank goodness I had also worked hard in school enough to be able to obtain an engineering degree. And so I did nothing but just go to school whenever I could.
Working during that late 60s era, people my age and older know about WVON. What was it like being in Chicago during that period? Because you had Jesse Jackson, you had the Nation of Islam that was coming into its own.
It was very, very exciting. Very exciting, very rewarding, and it's hard to explain. I mean, it was today for me, it's like that was it. That was really the life. We were all so equal. Even when we weren't equal, we took each other by hand and just pulled each other in.
Looking back, what has happened to your city from the time you grew up there and during your professional career to the helter-skelter things that are going on with our young people?
What has happened with our city is the same that's happened with other cities. Life has changed. Times have changed. Money is not the same.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a lot of money, but then it didn't cost as much to live.
Right.
And people were not hungry. Some people were on the street, but where you might see 10 of them,
mm-hmm.
compared to me looking out my window and seeing the guys under the viaduct today,
right.
that has changed. The civility of people and the caring about them being hungry has truly changed. It was okay to go to church and say you hadn't had anything to eat. Almost today in many areas, many churches are just not able to do what they'd like to do. Collecting money is a hard thing to do when you can't pay your own bills. And so there's so many different things that have contributed to where we are right now. And one of the other things was, and someone said that to me this morning, he said, I lived in your neighborhood. I lived, you know, Italians lived where you lived.
Mm-hmm.
Black people lived where you lived, and they were called Negroes then, and it was all okay. And he said, I remember getting beat up when I was 15 on the L. And someone said, well, how do you feel about that now? He said, I didn't think anything of it. It was just part of living in a mixed neighborhood.
Right.
And we didn't pull out a gun and kill each other. We just box each other out, and 15, 20 minutes, it was over, and you go on about your business.
Definitely right.
Those things have changed. We've had parents in the house at that time. We had mothers and fathers living in the same house. We had grandparents who also lived in the same house. And there was no such thing as you having the audacity to be disrespectful to your elders. And your elders could be, if you were 15 and they were 20 or 19, they were your elders. So that makes a difference. Today, grandparents are 30. It's very difficult when young people are not taught that older people should be respected and looked after, not discarded in America. We don't have that now.
No, that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Mary D., legendary television and radio personality and author of Life Lessons of Faith, Forgiveness, and Grace. Ms. D., you went into television in 1968, but in 1971, you started hosting your own show on WSNS. What was it about television for you to leave radio?
I didn't leave radio right away.
Okay.
I was in there in 66, and I had been in for, actually, I started earlier than that, a year later. I started in 66, 67, I had a show.
Okay.
And it was on I don't even remember now.
The WCIU?
CIU TV, yeah.
Okay.
And Don Cornelius.
Right.
And I pretty much started together and ended up on the same station together. But when I did go in, it was encouragement from other people,
okay.
who said, you know, TV is really coming up, and, you know, we need some color on TV, and you've got most of it, and you know sponsors and people like you, and you work around the clock, so why don't you go try it? So I thought, well, what the heck, I could go do that. I didn't really know all of it. I went back over to my school, and I told my teacher, and he said, just come on back in here and come on back in school, but in the meantime, go for it. So I heard maybe something was opening. I went over and introduced myself, and the rest is history.
I understand.
I was hired almost immediately. And I can't tell you that was so because I was so brilliant or so wonderful. I think it was because there weren't any of me.
Were you surprised with the reaction that you received from the community once you showed up on television?
I think surprise is not the word. I think people were so overwhelmed,
okay.
and so proud. I think that's what I saw more than surprise. I saw surprise from some communities,
mm-hmm.
because it was as though they never thought that that would happen.
Right.
So that was a surprise. But from my own community, there was just an outpouring across the country. It was amazing how in that time we didn't have that computerization that would take us across the country and tell us. We had E. Rodney Jones on WVON.
Right.
You know, who also lived in the South somewhere, Memphis or somewhere. And you know, the word just spread.
Were you conscious of the move that you were making? And was there any pressure you put on yourself to be the best that you could be?
Every day.
Okay.
Every day, every minute of every day. I understood what I had done. I understood the chance I had taken. And I understood that I could not fail. That failure for me personally was failure for a community. And then failure for the next community, which was the community of women. And then failure was the next community, which was a community of children. And there was no way that I could not. And so I began to work. And I interviewed everybody I could. And in my off times were used going to different churches. People would say, "So what denomination are you?" And I would kind of look at them a little confused, and they'd say, "Well, so where do you go to church?" And I'd laugh, and I'd say, "Anywhere I want. I just go to church. I pick up and I go to somebody's church, and they welcome me." So I visited churches all over, not just in Chicago, but all the communities. And pretty soon, you know, that spreads like wildfire.
You talk openly about the tragedy that struck you one evening leaving your broadcast that led you to write your book. Could you tell us about that evening and how has that shaped Ms. D to the woman she is today?
I certainly can tell you, and I'll try to do that as briefly as I can. I had done a television show, and a gentleman who had done another TV show wanted to be on my show. So he and his assistant waited to talk to me after. It was my custom to leave the station immediately because when I got through at night, it was got out of there around 9:30, going on 10 o'clock. And this time, my daughter was in California with my brother and my sister-in-law, so I wasn't worried about it. Dog was in the kennel, nobody home but the house. So I thought, well, okay, I'll stop and talk to them. And as we were talking, she said, "You know, there's a little restaurant right up the street, Miss D. Why don't you come have coffee with us?" I said, "No problem." This was something I had never done. I never went out with anybody. I always made a beeline to get home because my daughter was there. And with no responsibilities, I went, had coffee, set up, talked for about a half hour, 45 minutes, and turned around and came back. What we did was go in my car. My mentality always said, be on guard, take care of yourself because nobody's doing that for you, and be in the leadership role. Mm-hmm. The leadership for me that night was to be in my car, not in their car, as they suggested. So I drove up and I drove them back to in front of the TV station to their cars. When I got back, I saw a gentleman across the street in the dark, and I just happened to look over and see. He had on a 10-gallon hat, and I went like, huh, that looks like my producer, hesitantly. And I thought, oh, he lives right in the area. What is he doing standing over there? So I took my eye off of him because I thought that that was him. And the next thing I know is a guy was approaching the car. He approached the car. I didn't see his face. I took my eye off him again. My window was cracked open, which I never did. And I'm saying this because a lot of things went on that night that I had not done before. And the reason was because the gentleman who was sitting in the car, we were watching his assistant go to her car first. Then he was getting ready to get out and get in his car. the gun went right in the window in that little crack. All I could see was this silver gun and hear the voice that said, open the door, unlock it. Unlock it, don't do anything else or I'll kill him. So I unlocked the door. He said, move over. The gentleman moved over next to me. And the next thing I know is he was giving me directions to where to drive to. And I thought, well, I'm still kind of safe because I'm in the neighborhood of the TV station, and that's where the policemen are.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to a stoplight, kept on going, thinking if I go past the stoplight, somebody might see that. No one saw that. We drive up, and he tells me to stop, pull over, and a gentleman was standing on the street. He yells out to him, hey, Butch, I got him. I got him. Butch gets into the back seat. I drive to his car, as I'm told. He gets out, and I suppose he was following us in his car. I was made to drive to a forest preserve. At the end of that night, my guest and I were forced into the wooded area, and the guest was shot twice in the head and died. I was shot twice in the head, once in the back of my head, in the top, and once at the back of my skull, right at the meeting of the spine. Excuse me for hesitating.
No problem. Take your time.
And blacked out, I guess. When I came to, I was able to crawl. Mm-hmm. I tried to get up. I reached out and touched him. And said, I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm going to get help. I can get help. I'm alive. He was not moving. I tried to get up and couldn't, so I crawled like a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what got me, and this is a female thing, as I'm crawling, I'm thinking, I'm furious. This is furious. Not only did he choose somebody who does things for the community on a nonstop basis, he did something to somebody in his community who he did not know and he didn't get anything. He took my purse and he took his watch and whatever he had in his wallet. I didn't have anything. And the other thing was is that I had on my beautiful white silk suit, the first time I had worn it. And for somebody who was working two jobs and taking care of everybody, I didn't have money to go get anything else. So I got furious.
I know that's right.
That really, I believe, catapulted me
mm-hmm.
and gave me strength to push on because I got angry. And I pushed as far as I could, got out to a highway. When I hit that highway, I learned a word. F-E-A-R, false evidence appearing real. It ain't real unless it's real. I got to the highway and I thought that I saw this car that looked like mine.
Mm-hmm.
And instead it was not. Because I thought it was mine, I turned all the way around, crawled all the way back to where I was, and laid there with my fingers in my face and on my eye. And the reason that I had my fingers in my eyes, holding my head up, is because I didn't want to mess up my makeup. I don't know where I thought I was going, but I didn't want to mess up my makeup. It was bad enough I was already shot in the head and blood coming down my face. I laid there for another little while, and I don't know the length of time, but it was estimated that I only laid there probably another 30 minutes,
okay,
praying and thinking that somebody's going to find us, somebody's going to come in here. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that nobody was, that it was very quiet, and the only thing I could hear was the cicadas, the little bugs that you hear that sound like crickets,
mm-hmm.
I crawled back out to the highway. I was found by an ambulance. A woman had her husband in that ambulance, and she hit the ambulance because he passed me by. She told him, give me my husband, I'll take him to the hospital myself. You go back and get that one. When he came back, he and his assistant came over to look at me and said, what happened? I tried to explain as briefly as I could because I was pretty dizzy. And they said, at least the driver said, it's against the rules of the company to pick up anybody on the highway. Well, long story short, along comes a policeman on the other side of the highway. They did take me over on the other side with them, sat me on the side of their ambulance. The policeman comes over, asked me every question in the book except my mother's maiden name and her grave number. And I was told to just stand by the side of his car. Stand by the side of his car because I was bloody and muddy and too messy to sit down. He had called a paddy wagon. At that time, they called it a paddy wagon. I don't know what the wagon is called now. But the service wagon came, and he told them to go and get the man that was way back there in the wooded area. They brought him out and took him to the hospital, left me there with the policeman. Another one came and picked me up, and I went to the hospital on the floor of that wagon, bouncing with my head all the way to the hospital, pronounced dead twice, brought back, lost my eyesight, paralyzed legs. But I stand today as a testament that there really do have miracles, that miracles really do happen, that I am a child of God, was born a child of God, will die a child of God. And I'm so grateful for the education that I had in church and in school as a child. I never lost it.
Yeah,
and I teach it today. You're never alone. Never, never, never alone.
Ms. D, final question. When did you become involved with the Lou Rawls Telethon?
When it first went on the air, it came to the TV station where I was working and asked me what did I think and would the station management even listen to them. And I said, I don't think so, but let me go talk to some friends of mine. And those friends of mine were two very, very popular men, Harry Carey and Jack Brickhouse.
Okay.
They were everything. They were baseball.
They were baseball. Yes, ma'am.
They were all of baseball. And I told them, and they said, so what do you want us to do? I said, I want you to go with me when I go in there, because I was thinking, you know, this is going to sound really crazy. They want black people to do that on television. It had not been done before. And I said, and I want you all to commit to being on the show.
Mary D., legendary radio and television personality and author of Life Lessons on Faith, Forgiveness, and Grace. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.